Welcome to the Dance Futures podcast, the podcast that discusses dance as a way of life with people who've made it central to theirs. I'm your host, Dr. Ruth Pethybridge, professional dance geek, and this is series three. Honestly, I had to have a hiatus due to personal reasons, and I wasn't sure I was going to do a series three. So for any listeners who have come back, thank you, welcome. And to newbies, what happens is I think I'm not going to do anymore, and then I just meet people who are so fascinating that I just really want to have a conversation with them, and I think, well, I may as well record it then for the podcast. So this is a sharing of a recorded conversation with Cloud Tonietto for episode one. Cloud is a dance and movement artist. They work across disciplines and are currently working with company Prodigal UPG. And as a maker, Cloud is particularly inspired by queer theories and philosophical inquiries, which you'll hear really coming through in this interview. Their questions about identity and exploring humanity is all part of a kind of passionate drive to create spaces for queer stories and LGBTQIA plus communities to come together and work collaboratively. They've been supported by Pavilion Dance Southwest, Newnham Gallery and the Exchange Jupiter Gallery. They are currently based in Cornwall, which is super exciting for me because it's where I am too. And yeah, you will love them as much as I did.
I was gonna try and just I was about to say your full name, and then I realised I didn't know how to pronounce your second name.
Okay.
So can you do that bit for
my full name?
Yeah, please give me your full name.
It's Cloud Tonietto.
Tonietto.
Yes.
Nice.
Yeah.
And that's Italian.
It's Italian. Yeah. I've actually realised that I think the more I say it, the more when when I'm speaking to English people, I think I started saying it with a bit of an English accent.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
When
one of my first interactions when I was in the UK was someone commenting on my T, how I was pronouncing my T.
Okay.
Like the T. So that's something that I'm very conscious of. Yeah. And there's a lot of T's in my surname. So.
You do.
So it's like,
Tonietto. Isn't that just what you want, is someone commenting on how you pronounce
things like they
when,
wanna be,
when
yeah.
you arrive in a new country? I can only apologise for my people, I guess, as usual. Oh, God. Okay, great. Thank you. And I do remember when I first heard your name that I really thought like cloud in the sky, mm-hmm. and you must have that quite a lot as well, right? And I was like, oh, that's so beautiful. And then it's felt like this. I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
But I still, anyway, will always associate you with
fluffy white
things in the sky.
Floating thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nice.
So I really wanted to hear about your, I know like very little to nothing about it.
Yeah.
And I think it's one of those things where I just saw the title, mm-hmm. Queer Utopias, on your Instagram,
mm-hmm.
and went, and then what that like sparked for me in my imagination, and sort of just going, I wonder, like, what is that? What does that look like? What does it feel like? What is it for you?
Nice.
What would it be? I don't know. Yeah, it was just one of those little things that really made me pay attention, I guess. And
nice.
So then I was like, oh, I'd really like to hear more about what it is that you're doing.
Yeah.
And what you've done and what you're hoping for and how it manifests as a practice or, yeah.
Yeah. Also, as you're speaking, there's a lot of rainbow reflections on you.
Ah.
I don't know if you can, there's one here on the left, but also on you, there's like a whole strip of rainbow.
Oh, perfect. Queer Utopia, right?
Yeah. It's manifesting.
Yeah, it's manifesting. It's from the crystal hanging in the window, look.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. The title is something that I haven't actually tackled yet.
Okay.
Because I don't know if that's a title or... At the moment, that's kind of like the starting point.
Yeah.
But, I've kind of been like, oh, I think I need a title, but I don't know what it is, so that's what it is for now.
Okay.
So it's interesting that it's than something.
Yeah.
In terms of capturing attention.
Yeah, definitely.
In terms of where it started, I think it's been a kind of a bit of a journey of information that's kind of got to that point. But it mainly comes from some books that I've been reading. So I can go straight into the nerdy.
Like, go straight into the books. Yeah. I am a total nerd. I'm like, give me the book titles. Yeah. Love it. Yeah,
cool. So the very first one is, do you know Sarah Ahmed?
Yes.
So the Queer Phenomenology book.
Yeah, I love that book.
I loved what Sarah Ahmed talks about, the idea of like different orientations of the space that you're in and of people and as individuals and of society and all of these things, and talking about queerness as one of the things that kind of is a different orientation to the heteronormative system that we live in. But then the idea of kind of, she talks about how that can create disorientation when you are someone who is queer in a space that's that has very heteronormative straight orientation, which is like life mostly. But then she talks about this disorientation being something that's generative as a starting point of a positive thing that opens up a lot of possibilities and things that you wouldn't have if you just followed that and never questioned that given orientation. So I feel like that's also what, like, figuring out who I am has been for me, of just discovering loads of things of like, oh my gosh, I can do this, I can be this, I can choose. So that's an idea that really sticked with me. The second book is called Cruising Utopia by Jose Esteban Muñoz, I'm not sure if the pronunciation is right, who is quite a big queer scholar, and talks about the idea of queer utopia, and kind of says how queerness is something that only really exists in the future, because it's something that you can't never quite reach in the present because of the society that we live in, at least in this moment in time in the Western world and all of that. It's always something that you can like aim to reach towards or trying to get to, but never actually be in fully in that space. But what's possible to do in the present is dreaming of spaces that, or creating like temporary utopias where you can have a moment of that space within everyday life. I think that I really like that, and that's something that I've experienced in life, of kind of being in these spaces that feel very comfortable and easy, and can just be, and then the contrast of then going out into life and being like, okay, this is a bit of energy to exist before I can be. And like not feeling the difference. And then also I think in my practice as a dance person, kind of discovering how performance and movement can feel like a place where allows me to kind of explore like different versions of what I can be, and create these spaces of anything can be. So that was like, oh, maybe those things can come together. I guess I started with this question of how can I use my practice and this thing that's that movement and creativity and making is to figure out ways of creating these moments where we can create utopias, and yeah, kind of what does that mean? All the questions that you asked, what does that look like? What does it mean? How does it happen? So yeah, so that's kind of the very beginning point, and then kind of the bringing in imagination, so it becoming something that can go as far and wide into fantasy and whatever, yeah. Because why not?
Yeah. If you're gonna create utopia,
yeah,
why not create utopia? Yeah.
But also based in reality or the whole spectrum of that. So that's kind of general.
Yeah, and it's quite a lot. Like, I suppose as I'm hearing you talk, I'm thinking about like the macro and the micro, and so there's like these really like hearing you talk about Ahmed, and I'm sort of like, we're sitting around a kitchen table at the moment, and she uses the table as an example, and also really writes quite evocatively. Sorry about the dog. Writes quite evocatively. Not my dog. Hashtag not my dog. writes really evocatively about her experience of sitting at a dinner table, and kind of what the expectations of her family, and sort of how that's invoked then sitting around kitchen tables per se, and then also the table as an object in its own right. And forgive me, because I'm probably like paraphrasing really badly because I read it a while ago, but those are some of the things that I remember just because we were sitting at a table. And I suppose I'm sort of interested in then how, like, when we're thinking about the macro and the kind of wider context, how we kind of bring that back to the body.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, because I always find that with these ideas, it's like, how do we actually turn that into a practice or explore that in a way that's meaningful to the singular body or the collective moving together? How are you grappling with that? Are you?
I don't know. I think it's definitely still there as something that I'm still working out as well. And that's been part of the process, and I think there's so I've done a couple of residencies so far, and in one of them I invited a few people, friends and people, to come into the space and have conversations with me about what queerutopia is and all of those questions, and as a way of just kind of like collecting ideas and sharing conversation. And it's exploded into so many different directions.
Yes.
And we've been talking about like all sorts of different things, from like capitalism to healthcare to like how we view time to queerness in terms of sexuality and gender and all of, but it's like it's gone in so many different huge conversations. Which like was really exciting, but then it's also how do I then like bring it back,
sort of distill it in some way, right? As well, to something that you can practice with.
And then also a question of where does the body come in and movement, because that's kind of what I work with. I think there is something about the body and movement that's, I think, intrinsically utopian for me, because it's all about experiencing and sensing and kind of being in the moment, and it's something that feels quite spacious for like that thing of like imagining and just being and exploring, that offers that. That's kind of like an aside of how I think I'm bringing movement into this idea. But then in terms of the actual practice or whatever this is trying to be, I think I've tried to translate things that we'd been talking about, conversations and ideas, into what that means in terms of how we understand and approach the body and movement, and how. Because I guess it's that thing of everything about the structure that we live in then shapes how we think about things and how we perceive things. That if we lived in a in a commune, we probably would see like cooking and relationships and family, that those concepts would mean something completely different, like everything.
Mm.
So, I think trying to figure out how some things that shape our life also shape the way that we understand the body and therefore then live in the body. I guess like the idea of binaries has been, I'll say obviously because like, yeah, but it's been a big thing in terms of obviously the like gender binary, but also how then we understand the body as right and left, and like upper body, lower body, and like kind of like really separate it in binaries, which kind of makes sense in terms of understanding organizational things, but also you can't exist, right doesn't exist without left, and if you try and move only one side you can't really do anything. Kind of like all of those things of things that we take for granted of how we understand who we are that actually come from up there.
Yeah, top down, or sort of like hegemonic, which I can never say right, hegemony. I never know if it's hegemonic or hegemony. Like these ideas that we internalise from power structures or kind of knowledge that's taken as, you know, knowledge because it's fed to us from power structures actually rather than what we may be necessarily living. But yeah, I really like what you said there of like, yeah, but the right can't exist that left. And immediately I'm sitting here, I'm wanting to kind of like reach for the benefit of listeners. I'm like wanting to reach out my arms and be like, oh yeah, how does that feel to like experience right and left, but in relation to each other as a kind of continuum, or like what could I do with that as a mover? So that I think is a really beautiful example actually of how you've boiled something down to the microcosm of our own bodies.
I guess kind of trying to find things to explore physically, or we've had conversations about things not being the kind of losing a bit of sense of it all being individual and having a bit of sense of community and working together, and then I was thinking, oh yeah, that in the body as well, if you're moving one body part but actually everything is working and you can't really separate, and what if you actually give in to the idea of the whole body is working for that little body part to move. Kind of playing with some of these ideas.
Fascinating.
And then I think I have another question that is maybe not the micro, but it's still small in terms of my own, how things affect my own practice, of how all of these ideas how to try and make them become part of the way that I work with myself and with other people and with potentially institutions or places, or and what all of these ideas that for me are part of the queer utopia of like kindness and listening and curiosity and all of these, how to make them part of the working practice as well as the practice of making or
because I was going to say there's the table equivalent, you know, there's the equivalent of the table very much so, you know, in the dance studio and the dance sector, and so there's these kind of the ways that the industry and the way that we do things generally could really benefit from some of the things that you're talking about. And again, it's kind of like all the different levels at which that could function can become quite overwhelming, can't it? But it's really nice to think about bottom up as well, if you're somebody that works with other people or facilitates experiences or is even inviting people into the space, that you're thinking about how you're doing that, what you're creating when you do that, and in that microtopia, which is Claire Bishop's term, I don't know if you know her writing, she writes about participatory practice and ethics a lot in a really, she's great, Artificial Hells is one book I really love, I've heard. And yeah, so like thinking about what it is that you're creating, and then you hope that there's a way that those kinds of things also filter up and through and into wider society. I mean, I'm always saying that to my students about dance not existing in a hermetically sealed bubble that doesn't resonate outwards. Like, you have to think about it as something that's part of culture and society. It's not just you in front of a mirror in your leotard. Although, you know,
especially
exactly, not and yeah, who's allowed in those spaces and those sorts of the sort of alienation that might be created by something like a leotard, you know. It's those kinds of considerations are, I think, really really vital in the sector in general. And then in terms of the body, one of the things that made me think of, again, what you were saying about even how we understand our own bodies, because I know, you know, as a woman, definitely my own understanding of my body has been massively informed by patriarchy, and that's like a life's work to work with that. I don't think I'll ever lose it. Yeah. So, you know, it's a life's work working with that. And in the same way, in dance, you know, again, sort of working with and against these things that are kind of, they're just there. They're so, and they're still there and they exist. And yeah, so how do we work with and against those kinds of things, I suppose. And acknowledge as well that that's more labor for some people than others. You know, what's visible, what's invisible in the space, you know, these kinds of things. I've slightly lost my train of thought, but I think the list you gave was really nice as well. Oh, that's what I was thinking about as well. Hey, so what did you say? Curiosity, kindness, listening. Those are really nice qualities to think about. That's it. I was thinking about the table and the classroom, and so like there's been work around, you know, the way that space is arranged. Obviously that Ahmed's work is like really amazing to consider as well from that perspective of orientation and disorientation, but also again in terms of power, like how we arrange ourselves in a space and how we see ourselves. So you know, Steve Paxton did this whole thing about the backspace. So I find that really interesting, because I think we, you know, there's a tendency in training to, it can just feel very front on, and because of the way that classrooms and dance studios were, you know, traditionally organized. So it's stuff about the kind of dark side of the body and the backspace. It's really, I really like that. And I think I have to, again, have to work on my my proprioception sometimes. If I'm working alone, I maybe have to think about that more. I think if there's other bodies in the space, I'm more aware of like the relational field around me. And so then like more in touch with the back and everywhere. And, you know, like that's all sensing. But maybe if I'm on my own, I think maybe I can get a bit frontal or something. I don't know. Yeah, I was just thinking about that in relation to what you were saying about how we can let these ideas maybe change even how we relate to our own experience of our own bodies in the space, right?
Yeah. And I think actually Ahmed, I think, talks about the back space. Okay. Or I think there is something about the idea of orientation being what is in reach, which is normally in front of you, or like what you can see. But then if you change your orientation, you
see a whole other perspective. That's so nice.
Talking about what's behind you that you can't see, but maybe it's in reach.
That's so nice, isn't it? Well, so I love the simplicity of that as well.
As well
of just turn around.
Yeah.
Who knows what you might find? Do you know what I mean? Like behind you, just there.
Yeah.
Or like, I really... I did a thing around disorientation with the pole, actually, which is again a really interesting paradox, because obviously the context that pole dancing is most known for, etc., which invokes all these things, which I'm not gonna talk about that side of it in relation to exotic dancing and all of that, because it's a whole plug hole, which I don't want to distract from what we're talking about. But my experience of working with the pole, one of the things that was really, that I really loved about it, was finding myself, and it's the same actually with contact a bit. And so for me, there's something around having this other body, whether that's a body or a inanimate body, that can invite me to discover other possibilities, right? So I'd find myself upside down, or like whizzing really fast around, like you do when you're a kid in the playground and you're like, whoa, like what just happened, kind of feeling, or getting really dizzy. But that was then helping me to just kind of feel different.
Yeah.
Literally as simple as that. It's like kind of upside down, or finding myself in a position, and then the world looks different from that perspective. And so, yeah, I think at a very basic level, there's something simple about it, as well as extremely complex.
Yeah. I think for some reason I'm thinking about how, I guess, adding the pole into movement is kind of giving something that allows but some kind of change to happen, or offer something that allows to, like, experience something different. And then I'm thinking, when we talked about like Paxton and training and leotard, that a lot of this, I think there is a lot in this that for me is undoing a lot of training that I've had.
Yeah.
And but how that's living in my body, and yeah, and then I was thinking about the pole being the thing that maybe can come in and help undo some of it, because it offers something different. And so now I'm thinking about what that can, other things can come in and do that.
Yeah, it's some sort of interruption in the space or in my habits as well, right? Like sometimes it's just, like you say, some of that's training and some of it's your kind of impulses, which again, maybe that's also training in a bigger way, you know, or as well.
Conditioning,
yeah. So, but how you... Yeah, there are ways to sort of interrupt that, and maybe sometimes it's this cold, hard metal pole in the middle of the room that's like, ugh, and it does, it makes, it's really awkward and uncomfortable sometimes as well, and just like, ah, oh, horrible. but yeah, that somehow that it shifted, yeah, it just shifted something for me in terms of like a way of working, again, a way of working alone, especially in the pandemic, because of not having other bodies people. And people. So yeah, I don't know, maybe there are some objects in Queer Utopia.
Yeah, maybe.
There are some strange shaped objects that we can kind of play with and have it. And yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, nice.
So you've done a couple of residencies.
Yeah.
What do you have like a, is there, do you have like an A, like there's this lovely open question. Do you have a sense of what you, is it going to be in a constant state of becoming as part of your practice? Do you have something that you'd ever like to open up to bigger? I don't know, is there some sort of aim, or what's how you feel?
It's all a big question. I think still in the figuring out space. I think there is something in this kind of bringing it back to the body and undoing and redoing and figuring out different ways of seeing the body that I'm really interested in, that I'd like to explore more for my own like practice, and maybe, but then also with people, just because I feel like I have a lot of I think it would be nice to take charge of my own. I feel like I still have a lot. I guess movement has been quite a journey for me, also in my discovering, and like when I was figuring out, because of my past training, especially when I was back in Italy and I was doing a lot of ballet, and it was in quite a kind of like toxic environment.
Okay,
and,
I
feel like I still have a bit of baggage that I'm carrying with that, but also then going on this gender journey for my own, like in my own personal life, that then obviously is coming to my movement practice. And I feel like there is a lot that I I still put on my body from the outside, in terms of how I, for example, when I was this exploring with binaries, and I was like, my mind still wants to read feminine and masculine in what in some things I do in the movement. And for some reason that feels like it makes me feel like I want to move away from movements that my brain reads as feminine, because that doesn't feel like somewhere I should go. But then it's like, but then it's my body and it's my movement, and I want to be able to go everywhere. And
that's what I was going to say, isn't it, about not letting those binaries define you, rather than like maybe those energies still exist.
Yeah.
It's about allowing the spectrum of what they can be in one body.
Yeah.
Or something. I don't know if I'm expressing that very well. I'm really curious about that myself, of like how, yeah, like certain things are defined as being more masculine, but I kind of go, well, actually, can't that also be, that could also be feminine, and what is feminine could also be masculine. So it's actually not so much more fluid than these binaries, but there is something in maybe acknowledging that those energies still exist, so that we can, again, like I said, like work with them and against them and kind of through them, I don't know.
Yeah, and just confuse them and use them all. And
yeah, exactly, and, because otherwise I feel like, I suppose I feel like maybe that's, there's a realist sort of thing, I don't know, or just kind of acknowledging, like we're never going to get back to a fully blank slate or something.
Yeah.
So I think like working through the baggage is really important, but also it's kind of like, how can we like play with it as well, and like exist in a way that where it's not oppressing, that masculine feminine isn't oppressing, but it's actually a freeing thing where you can dip into both, or like be exist across and through and with, I don't know. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it?
And it's the idea of the all options and possibilities instead of being something that
is
given to you. And but yeah, I kind of want to get to that point where I'm like, oh, I can actually, it's, yeah, kind of take charge of all of those things instead of seeing them as things that are put on me.
Yeah.
Or in the same way as like, if I'm like moving and my body does something that goes into the kind of like ballet vocabulary, then I'm like, oh no, I'm not going there.
Okay.
But actually, I want to be able to go there, and because it's my choice, and I kind I don't, I feel like I have a word I'm looking for, I can't find it. But yeah.
No, that makes it makes a lot of sense. Yeah, it's kind of taking ownership over those things that have maybe before been something that you were doing because of various external reasons or pressures or expectations, and actually going, you know, it is part of me now because I've done that training, so it's going to be there in the body, but actually I can choose to access it and use it in a way that is that works for me, but you don't have to take on all the bullshit that comes with it, kind of thing. Or do you, you know? I think that's a really lovely open way of thinking about it, definitely.
So I think there is something there that I feel like feels quite rich that I want to kind of delve into. And a lot of other things that come with that as well. I also feel like there is something about doing this with people, or like having, opening this space up and inviting people, because I feel like there is a lot about, when I think about utopia, that also is about like relationships or like spaces that involve other beings and things that are bigger than just my body, and kind of having some kind of collective imagining or some kind of space that is shared with people that I guess it's also something about exploring how we all will have different ideas of what utopia is, but how can we make a space where they can all coexist? And then it's a place of practicing that, like, kindness and curiosity and generosity and all of that we can practice in this microcosm that we can create together. and then maybe we can take out somehow, or just have a moment of it. So I think there is something about doing, exploring it with people. But yeah, but then I also have a thing about the idea of productivity that's kind of come up a lot in the thinking about utopia and capitalism, and this thing of having a product and yeah. the product being the most important thing over the experience, where I think in my idea of utopia it's all about the experience and the journey, and then something will come out of it.
Yeah, but, totally.
So I'm also trying to navigate how, and then in logistical, practical terms of what a project means, is all about, it's all about the end point.
Yeah.
And measuring, or like proving what that is, measuring yeah. what that is, and the worth of what you're doing is
defined by
yeah. the end. Yeah. yeah. So I think I'm also trying to figure out what that is.
Yeah. How can we model alternatives in terms of working practices as well, isn't it, of what we came back to? Or like, is it possible to let go of those models to the extent that you don't anymore also need it to be, become anything sort of more concrete than, as you said, like a way that there's some way of like sharing that with other people. And I think your thing about how can we coexist with these different ideas is really, obviously that's the kind of thing that the world would be a better place if we had a bit more of that kind of attitude, wouldn't it? But definitely, because one of my questions was who belongs in a utopia?
Yes, I was going to ask you.
So I was like, so that was one of my things, was like the feeling like you have the right to be there or contribute or... you know, what are the criteria at a very basic level kind of thing. And I think, you know, that's something that I've been exploring in relation to kind of, you know, I'm even hesitant to say it because I worry that queerness is so much associated with sexuality. And as someone who's more attracted to men in general, but have had feelings for women, but I have this kind of thing of going, well, I'm not experienced in that, and I haven't really been in a relationship with a woman, and then I'm taking up space in a place where I can I'm a you know, straight, essentially white middle class woman, educated, and I don't know. So it's like then you're getting into kind of the fragility of making it about me, and it's kind of the thing of recognizing how important this stuff is for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, in relation to queer families, because I didn't grow up in a normal, inverted commas, heteronormative family situation.
Mm-hmm.
And my own life is now, is evolving in a way away from that. And I'm realizing mm-hmm. how actually uncomfortable that was for me to try and do that. And really relishing and recognizing queer networks that actually are supporting me now so much to feel validated in that rather than a failure, basically. But yeah, so I have a question around my own sort of right to be in a queer utopia, even though I might really want to be. I might be there going, please let me in, it looks really fun in there. I think that's just where I'm at personally, I guess. But it's kind of an interesting, because as soon as you create any kind of community, there can be these exclusionary boundaries around it.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm wondering, do you have any what are your exclusions?
There's so much in there.
That's
a very interesting point, and I think it's actually something that I have been wondering as well of. I don't want to like police who
but you look so good in a police outfit now.
And I feel like it's also, I guess it goes, it's related to the conversation around labels and what are labels, and they're still limiting by being labels, but they're also really useful when you like I found them really useful in my life of being of feeling like, oh, there's other people and it's but at the same time they are limiting and they do come from the system that wants to put to categorize things and create separation and so I think it's kind of it's such a big thing, but then I also feel like if someone is into the idea of queer utopia, I feel like great, and it's almost like I personally feel like we're all a bit queer or something. And it's just how in like the different like people like on in different places on the spectrum, but also some people might allow themselves to feel that more than others or to experience that more than others, and also what does that look like can be really different for different people, and it's not all about who you want to sleep with, but it's all
and there's a really bell hooks wrote a really famous quote about that, right, which is about queerness not being all about who you sleep with, which she articulated much better than I am. I think it's the thing of being, I think what you're saying about labels is really interesting, isn't it? But I think it's like the way that queerness has gone from this, its journey in language itself is like super interesting, right? From kind of a slur to a chosen kind of thing, and that there's a thing that happens in culture that's been noted by cultural studies scholars of this kind of like the cycle of like appropriation, really, where like a subculture, an idea that's generated in a subculture because it's needed to kind of identify themselves against the norms of the time, gets then appropriated by the mainstream and turned into something else. And we see it in Pride, blah, blah, blah. And I suppose I'm just mindful of not doing that as somebody in a relatively, you know, relatively privileged position. But I also think that it's like the anti-racist work. I also feel like we have to recognise that actually a queer utopia would be fucking great for everyone, right?
Exactly.
It's about the values that you've just, some of the values that you and practices that you've talked about, how, they would serve, you know, it's like the patriarchy doesn't serve anyone, they would serve everyone. But obviously those are quite macro things. And then there's the level at which actually, if you, in your practice, you want to invite other people in and to share that space and who those people are and what that is for you as an artist as well.
And it's a question I think I haven't, so far, I guess my interactions in terms of, I think it's not been limited to only queer people, actually, mostly, but not only. That's potentially something that needs... and I think it's like I was living heteronormative life for a while, and I wish that someone came and was like, so why are you choosing that?
Okay, nice.
Is that because you think that that's what you have to do, or is that because you want it? So yeah, I guess it's that thing of like in my, I think I had a conversation, I don't remember who, but I had a conversation with someone about would there be straight people in queer utopia, and I would like to think that there can be straight people, you know, but because I imagine it being a space where heteronormativity isn't the orientation that Ahmed talks about.
And
that's also a choice that people make, and it's not a thing of I'm accepting that life that's given to me, but I have all these options, and I'm going to choose the one that works for me. And then we're all in the same place, because then we have all chosen.
Yeah, rather than one being the model that we're given, and then anything else is deferring from that.
Yeah.
Yeah, just to my original premise for this podcast, it's called Dance Futures. So that thing that you said about queerness always existing in the future, and I think I also influenced by the pandemic and kind of going, what does dance look like after this? How do we get back to it? How do we reform it? And of course, like with many things, you know, things get lifted and we go back to normal and you're like, oh, actually there are things about normal that weren't so great. Wanting to think about, so my premise was also around how can we imagine a future where dancing is more integral to everybody's lives, more central to everyday life. It's not this kind of niche thing that we go off and do, or that people can only do when they're pissed because they need to let go and that's the only way they know how. You know, I mean, I've done some great dancing in festivals and fields this summer, so I'm all up for that as well. But I just, there's something about the need for that that I feel is proportional sometimes to how little of it there is in the rest of life. And so that was my utopia vision. Nice. So you're, again, I think that's why the queer utopias idea sort of stuck with me, because I think that process of imagining something and exploring it is part of creating it, right? I mean, it's part of putting those ideas into the world.
There's another book that I've been reading that's called, something of Imagining Otherwise. It's by Lola Olufemi. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it
okay.
Right.
We can put
really
all the
bad referencing. Sorry.
If any students are listening, don't write something.
How you do it?
Something.
Experiments in Imagining Otherwise.
There you go.
Got it.
You got there in the end.
That talks about imagination being like a tool for revolution, like an initial tool for revolutions. Of you have to start. Every revolution start with imagining a possibility for something, to then make it a reality.
Ah, that's beautiful. Yeah, that's so nice.
That's also paraphrased, so it might not be quite.
There's been a lot of paraphrasing in this conversation.
Yeah.
That's really nice. I think that's a really nice thing to end on. Every revolution starts with imagining otherwise. I look forward to hearing more about it, and also the embodied explorations sound really fascinating. Luca, welcome to season 3. Live and direct from Frankfurt.
I have moved to Frankfurt now. I've been here for 6 weeks.
Amazing. So I like to think that this is going to bring like a whole, you know, really like international feel to the podcast. Yeah. And you can, you know, scope out any interesting artists over there for us as well and see if you meet anyone that you think we should be talking to. I feel like it's a bit sad that I've said 3 is the magic number. It's the third series and we don't have our third member of the Dance Futures gang, Robin Alvarez, but she's on holiday, so what are you gonna do?
Yeah, she's on holiday in a really nice place as well, so
we'll
too sorry for her.
So I feel like Cloud's interview, like the concept that they're working with, is such a great place to kind of begin something. And as I said in the interview, the way that it resonates with some of the ideas I wanted to work with for this podcast around a future where dancing is a more taken for granted thing. So yeah, I really enjoyed our conversation and the concepts that they were working with. What did you think? Did you have a listen?
Yeah, I found it really exciting, because as a member of the queer community, it's really nice to hear that other people are working in this way and kind of incorporating quite what can be viewed as quite abstract concepts about utopias or kind of what's the word I'm looking for? I suppose they're an ideology in their own way, and bringing them into the dance studio and then using dance and their dance practice as a means of improving their own and other people's lives around them. That dance is kind of used as this membrane to allow these like academic abstract ideas to come into the human body, and then it comes through the membrane and out the other side into life. And that's really nice.
I wish the listeners could see your hand, your little hand dance that you did. If in doubt, resort to interpretive dance. Maybe we're going to have to put that on the socials. Yeah, lovely, yeah. That idea of a membrane. So there's something kind of filtering through of these really massive ideas.
Yeah.
Manifesting in and through, you know, Cloud's, in this instance, Cloud's dance practice. Yeah, that's a lovely way of putting it. And I think probably speaks to one of the things that I was most kind of struck by in a way, which is this thing of the way that they're exploring just how their body moves and thinking about what queerness means even in that way, you know. So it's not actually, they're not necessarily talking about sexuality and gender, but they're talking about actually these ways of moving that become also normalized, you know, and also just our habits. And I guess that's what queerness, part of what queerness brings to the world, which is so beautiful about it, is this ability to kind of blow open some of these things that we might take for granted in a heteronormative society. And I feel like they were doing that with dance practice in terms of just this thing of like thinking about the binaries of right and left in the body and how might we kind of disrupt that. I found that like a really super like enlivening idea to like go away as well and work with and play with and be like, yeah, what does that mean? Do you know what I mean? Did that resonate with you, that kind of queering your own dance?
Yeah, totally. Especially in relation to Cloud's ballet training. And how I approached my own ballet training, and very quickly I found the binary in the codified technique really restricting.
Yeah.
So I just started learning whatever I wanted to learn, regardless of whether it was the male or female variation, inverted commas used there for both male and female, and subverting that very clear binary that exists in ballet.
That's interesting. So you mean you were learning whichever role you wanted to?
Whichever role, whichever steps.
Yeah.
And
how did teachers respond to that then? Were you allowed? Is that a thing?
I mean, I'm a bit of a I'm quite strong-willed and And I think my teachers very quickly just realized that I was going to do whatever the fig guy wanted in my ballet classes.
Nice work there with the fig. Yeah.
And then I was thinking about how that related to your conversation with Cloud about how a queer utopia can benefit everyone, regardless of their own gender or sexuality or, you know, personal identity. And I've started teaching my own ballet classes after school now, and I work at a school, there's some exposition there, and I've started teaching my own ballet classes, and I wanted to make them accessible to everyone without having to make a big deal about it's not a queer ballet class, it's just a ballet class. But the way that I'm teaching it is perhaps in academic terms a queering of the ballet technique, because I'm not enforcing this binary onto the students and how they want to learn. And I do have non-binary, gender non-conforming students attending my class, and I feel like it would be wholly wrong to kind of make them choose.
That's so interesting, isn't it, in terms of like the pedagogy of ballet and how if we could kind of work from the bottom up, you know, yeah, with those kinds of ideas, it would actually also change the form, you know, going forward, and then what younger people engaging with ballet are seeing and understanding as appropriate and things like that. I think that's
And then it also benefits the non-queer people in the room, because femininity is a spectrum, masculinity is a spectrum, and there may be women that attend my dance class who feel a little bit apprehensive about entering the ballet space, which is typically about being, or the traditional stereotype is like the Balanchine ideals of being white and skinny and wearing a pink leotard and tutu, which you touched on with Cloud. And I think if you create a space where anybody, regardless of who they are, can pick and choose what they want to do with the ballet language, then you create an equal playing field for everyone. And the same goes for a man or a young boy entering the space as well. They may not feel comfortable being like that brash sort of camp macho version of masculinity that ballet offers, and they can find something softer or more feminine for themselves. And I think that's really important.
Yeah, and I think you're right, that really resonates with the idea of the queer utopia, in the way that Cloud was describing it, as in who belongs there, of sort of going, yeah, like, is there a place for straight people in queer utopia? And it's kind of like, well, yeah, as long as that's not the standard bearer, that's not the thing that you're measuring other people against, and in some kind of, as having some kind of lack or some kind of othering happening there.
Yeah,
I think, yeah, like you say, so that level playing field, like, who knows if we'll ever get there, but I think that is a fantastic future to aspire to.
Definitely.
Yeah. Dance futures, queer utopias. I'm so sorry, anyone in America, why I went a bit. Yeah.
yeah.
All right. Thanks, Luca. I think that's a great note to end on. Let's all work towards that future, and see you in Frankfurt next time.
See ya.
And now, dear listeners, the bit you've all been waiting for, or the bit where you turn this off because you've listened to the interview and you're like, and now there's this weird bit where Ruth waffles on. This is the geek out section. So if you're new to the podcast, it's where I take a little bit more of a dive into the world of dance scholarship in a bid to kind of share it really in a bit more of an accessible way with more people. Because let's face it, the bookshelves of kind of dance academia are not frequented by many people. And it's a privilege when you are studying in an institution where you can do that, but very soon getting hold of kind of texts and very specific specialist pieces of writing becomes harder. So that was kind of part of my mission for this podcast, was to share the love a little bit of dance scholarship. So off the back of the interview with Cloud, I did a bit of Googling, which is always a good litmus test for what's out there before you search a little wider. And I'm sort of fascinated by how queerness might apply in the dance context, because there's been such a lot of debate about gender in dance for a really long time as a very sort of female dominated art form that has similar kind of power struggles once it gets to positions of power, and kind of looking at the gender imbalance in relation to the actual kind of labor force of the people doing the dancing, as it were, right down to kind of the gender and sexuality debate around men dancing, about how much it's associated with a kind of effeminacy, as Luca talked a little bit about. So it's a very
it's a very present discussion already, but what queerness brings to the table is, I think, so helpful and inspiring, and helps move away from these binary discussions of men and women, obviously, which is not to say that they don't exist, those discussions and some of the issues raised, but really to open it up. So I found a book called Queer Dance, Meanings and Makings by Claire Croft. Now, this was published in 2017, the same year that I finished my PhD. So it's fairly recent. And I would say that in it, she is really making a bid to, like I say, open up rather than define. So she's saying that no single entity marks itself as queer dance. So there's not some kind of style or the kind of people doing it that would necessarily define it as queer. And she very much aligns it with queer activism, which embraces anti-racist work as well, and is very aligned with feminism too. So that was really exciting. Her journey into queerness was very much informed by feminism, which I found a really useful narrative for my own sort of story, I guess. And she talks about how queer is what emerges among and across and between things. So there are these kind of multiple layered identities, and how those play out on the dance floor and on stage. She gives equal importance to sites of social dance and concert dance. And that's significant, of course, for queer communities, because the dance floor has often been a place, somewhere to express different ways of being, or somewhere to feel safe and seen when the rest of the world didn't feel like that. So that's really significant, that lack of hierarchy. And I've got to read this quote, which just made me really excited. While I love watching dance in the theatre and on the stage, I'm a big fan of the dance floor, the social dance floor, the club. This quote really got my geek on. She's talking about kind of the dance floor is a place where we can imagine. So a bit like Cloud talked about imagining otherwise. And she writes that the overlay of dreaming and doing allows bodies to come together into many configurations of coalition and collectivity. This unsettles the primacy of the heterosexual male-female couple and the nuclear family we imagine it naturally creates as society's foundation. While the dance floor is not immune to heteronormativity, its enactment of other ways to relate, valuing temporary attachments and meaningful relationships that extend beyond couples, opens possibilities for imagining how people can and do connect. I mean, can I get an amen up in here? For me, that's such a liberating premise. There's so much more I could say about queer dance and all the things that book is exploring, and I am waiting for it to arrive with a satisfying thud through my letterbox any day now. So I've ordered a hard copy, and I'll probably be dipping into that as this series progresses. I hope you've enjoyed episode one. Please follow us on Instagram @DanceFuturesPodcast and share the love. Keep dancing. Until next time.